Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's worse than you said, because you said, I think, oh, some people who are only a little bit overweight are getting it. It's worse than that. There are lots of people who are not overweight at all who are getting it, who are getting it to go from being a healthy weight to being super slim, or indeed people who are super slim who have eating disorders who are getting it to actively starve themselves. So yeah, it's not just that people who aren't obese are getting it. It's even worse than that.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
The Ozempic divide. Where do you sit on it? This new breed of weight loss drug, the glucagon-like peptide 1 agonist, sold under the brand names Ozempic, Wegovy, and now Mounjaro, were initially developed for diabetes patients, but they have since exploded into the weight loss market and, of course, all over Hollywood, when it was discovered that these drugs also suppressed appetite and thusly result in significant and to some extent lasting weight loss, so long as you stay on the drugs for life, which of course is risky because no one in fact knows if this is safe to do so yet. Now, I've written over at my Substack about the sociological divides these drugs have created, particularly in the body positivity communities. But I've since learned that the rifts, the contradictions, the health pros and cons, and the competing vested commercial interests are more extensive and high stake than I'd initially imagined, something I realised after reading a recently released book, Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs, by today's guest, Johan Hari. Johan and I have spoken before on Wild about his previous book, the international bestseller Stolen Focus, and he emailed me a few weeks ago to see if I'd conduct one of his first podcast interviews for his new book to ease him into the publicity circuit. I totally get his approach. It can be super nerve-wracking doing the first few chats after your very contentious, science-heavy book comes out. Now, with this topic, there is a lot to take in. Around about a quarter to a third of people in countries such as the US, UK and Australia are now obese or overweight. And in many countries around the world, it's the biggest cause of death. Yet, 80 to 90% of diets fail. These new drugs, currently injectable but likely to become a pill soon, can reduce someone's weight by up to 25% and cut the risks of death or illness from a long list of related side effects in massive chunks. But they themselves dial up the risk of pancreatitis, gut issues, depression, and thyroid cancer. So it's all very complicated. Other divides and ambivalences include the shift from overweight and obesity being discussed as a failure of willpower to this new mindset that these drugs have sort of landed, that obesity is a disease that can be fixed like any other disease with a drug. Ozempic and the other similar drugs are also dividing the world into, well, more haves versus have-nots, as Hollywood and the moneyed elites buy up the supply of drugs to be used as luxury cosmeceuticals, denying access to diabetes patients and the poor. The whole phenomenon is also setting us up for yet another race to the bottom, where we all feel we have to take part in a world where having an average BMI simply won't cut it anymore in the aesthetic stakes. And yet it is estimated that in 10 years' time, 20 to 30% of the population will be on these obesity drugs. While the Danish corporation that makes Ozempic has overnight become the most valuable company in Europe. Johan and I talk through all of this and more. And as always, he presents the complexity in a wholly accessible way, dripping in facts. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Johan, so lovely to see your face again and to be chatting and to be talking through your next wild, big, deep adventure into something dark that's happening in our society today.
That's my purpose in life.
You will find it. You're a dog with a bone. This time you've written a new book, Magic Pill, that talks through your Ozempic journey. So maybe we can start with a few of the basics of this new generation of weight loss drug. I think many people are still ignorant of the basics, even if they know about the hype and the hysteria. So how does Ozempic and the similar drugs work? I mean, it started out as a diabetes medication, right?
Yeah, I learned the answer to this from some of the scientists who played a key role in designing these drugs and from traveling all over the world from, you know, Reykjavik to Tokyo to Minneapolis to talk to the biggest supporters of the drugs, the biggest critics of the drugs and everyone in between. So the drugs work in what at first seemed like it was a very simple way. So if you ate something now, whether it's an apple or a Kit Kat or whatever, if you ate enough of it, you'd get a signal in your gut, which would be the release of a hormone called GLP-1. And that hormone is just a natural signal in your body saying, stop eating, you've had enough. And there's a whole array of these gut hormones that are released that give you these signals to just slow down or stop. But naturally, in nature, these gut hormones only stick around in your system for less than 10 minutes. It's usually enough to make most of us stop, but then they go away. What these new drugs do is they inject into you a copy of those hormones, a copy of that signal to stop eating, but instead of getting washed away in a few minutes, these fake kind of replica hormones stay in your system for a whole week. So you basically don't want to eat very much and you feel very full very fast. So for me, it was bizarre. I remember the morning after I started taking them, I was feeling very conflicted about taking these drugs that were I was conscious of the benefits, I was really worried about lots of downsides, which I'm sure we'll get to. I remember waking up and having this really weird feeling and thinking, what do I feel? And I couldn't place it for a minute. And I suddenly realized that I didn't feel hungry. Every morning of my life up to that point, I had woken up feeling really hungry. In fact, a lot of mornings I was woken up by my stomach rumbling and I just wasn't hungry. And I went to the cafe up the road and I ordered the thing I used to order every day for breakfast. It was a big chicken roll with lots of mayonnaise. And I had like two or three or four mouthfuls of it. And then I was just full and I couldn't eat anymore. And then I went for lunch at the same place I always went to. It was a Turkish restaurant also around the corner. I ordered a Mediterranean lamb, which is what I usually ordered. Again, I had like a few mouthfuls. I couldn't have any more. And that was how it went from then on. It was like a kind of shutters had come down on my appetite. And I was literally about 80% less hungry than I had been before. It was very disconcerting. But that is the physical effect of these drugs. It was initially thought that these kind of replicas of the hormone worked primarily on your gut, that they slowed down gastric emptying or had some other stomach and gut effects. And it does have effects there. But actually, the evidence is increasingly clear. And I learned this from speaking to the experts, that it's primarily having an effect on your brain. It makes you want less food, which opens up a whole different set of potential benefits and side effects I'm sure we'll get to.
Yeah, so well, let's talk through some of those benefits. And I should just flag, you had been struggling with diets and weight gain and weight loss and food noise, you know, which is a word that's been thrown around in this debate quite often for a lot of your life. And you know, the ambivalence that you felt came from you were sick of feeling this way. But then, of course, you also academically know there, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Wrong phrase.
A very small free lunch.
But yeah. So I would love you to actually just spend a little bit of time talking through some of the benefits. So you've mentioned the idea that obviously stops you eating as much because you're just not as hungry. It dials down that food noise, which can just preoccupy a person's life and just dominate. But there are other, just top line, if you can just rattle off some of the other benefits that actually trickle on from people being able to finally combat obesity and overweight. You know, things like inflammation. There's an impact on even cancer and joint health and that kind of thing.
It was the weirdest thing working on this book. It was quite different to some of my other books in that the subtitle of the book is The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. And I think everyone listening who's overweight or obese is going to be able to get access to these drugs. And that's a big if, because obviously they're expensive at the moment, is going to face a similar kind of dilemma to the one that I faced. Sorts of moral dilemmas, emotional dilemmas, and actual dilemmas of weighing the scientific risks. So the benefits come down to one thing, which is they enormously reduce and in most cases reverse obesity. So I'm taking Ozempic, which is also marketed as Wegovy. It's the exact same drug, but for different purposes. And I've lost 3 stone. The average person taking Ozempic loses 15% of their body weight in the first year. Then the next set of drugs, which is called Mounjaro, which operates on not one gut hormone, GLP-1, but 2 gut hormones, GLP-1 and a different gut hormone called GIP, causes on average people to lose 21% of their body weight. And the next generation of these drugs, known as triple G, causes on average people to lose 24% of their body weight, which is only slightly below bariatric surgery. And the benefit is essentially one thing. It reverses obesity, and obesity on average, unfortunately, and I wish this wasn't the case, really, really increases the odds of all sorts of harms to your health. So we know from the evidence about what happens after bariatric surgery, how much reversing obesity leads to health gains. So bariatric surgery is a horrific form of surgery, horrifically onerous. 1 in 1,000 people die during it. There's a lot of downsides to that. But after the surgery, we know, which is up to now is the best comparison point, right? It's something that reverses obesity very quickly. You are 56% less likely to die of a heart disease in the 7 years following the surgery. 60% less likely to die of cancer, 92% less likely to die of diabetes-related causes. In fact, reversing obesity is so powerful that you're 40% less likely to die of any cause after you have bariatric surgery. And it looks like the early research is that these drugs are having a similar effect. So, for example, if you take these drugs and at the start you had a BMI higher than 27, you're 20% less likely to then have a heart attack or stroke in the next few years. And that was very much at the forefront of my mind because, you know, I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be. He had a heart attack and died when he was 44. My dad's had heart problems because he was overweight. My uncle died of heart problems. I kind of realized when you're young, these kind of the health problems, health complications related to obesity can seem very abstract and far away. You know, the height of COVID, someone I really love, one of my closest friends who I kind of bonded with over our love of shitty junk food, you know, died. And I kind of thought, you know, and this is not to say that body positivity people don't have lots of important points where they are right. They do, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But on the core point, the scientific evidence is absolutely overwhelming that obesity seriously harms health. And these drugs massively reduce obesity and therefore massively boost your health. Now, you've got to weigh that benefit, which is enormous, against a whole array of risks. There are 12 really big risks that I write about in the book that we need to think about carefully.
I mean, there's a couple of quick questions that I have as you're talking. You've got to take this drug for life, don't you, to keep that weight off. It's not something that you can just take for a while. You can lose the weight and then go back to everyday living. Have I got that right?
So this is being debated. The early studies, which we should take with a little pinch of salt, because they're funded by the drug companies who obviously have a vested interest in this.
Indeed.
But what they suggested, if you stop taking the drug, you regain 70% of the weight you've lost within a year. So it's a pretty big regression. Now, within that, there were some people who managed to keep the weight off, but they seem to be a minority. And this is still being figured out and debated. So generally, the way that the experts who've studied these drugs carefully talk about it, is it's not like, you know, sometimes some drugs just cure an illness, right? This isn't like that. It's more like statins for blood pressure. You know, if you take blood pressure pills, they'll lower your blood pressure. If you stop taking the pills, your blood pressure will go back to what it was before. They're a sort of temporary treatment for an ongoing condition. They're not a cure for the problem. So it's not like, it's one of the reasons why you have to think very carefully about starting to take them. It's not like having a holiday fling. It's like a marriage, right?
Are there issues with tolerance?
One of the fascinating things about these drugs is so many basic questions like the one you're asking, we don't know the answer to. So I asked lots of the experts this and I got a complete range of opinion from yes, it's likely to cause tolerance to no, it doesn't seem to be. So the people who say it doesn't seem to cause tolerance point to diabetics. So diabetics have been taking these drugs for 18 years on license now. And they don't seem to be developing tolerance. It's not like they need increasing doses to get the same effect, which is what would happen if they got tolerance. So the effect doesn't seem to wear off. It's possible there's a pessimistic scenario, which is perfectly possible, which is that people develop tolerance. So all this does is it opens a window of opportunity in which you would be able to interrupt your dysfunctional relationship with food potentially and build in place some other strategies. We don't know.
In Australia, it's prescription only and only for diabetes patients at this stage. However, I am aware that there are Australians who are getting hold of these drugs from the States predominantly. Is that the situation in the UK as well?
So in London, it's prescription only, but it can be prescribed to treat obesity. Oh, and sorry, Sarah, there's one thing you just said, and that's really important. It's worse than you said, because you said, some people who are only a little bit overweight are getting it. I mean, it's worse than that. There are lots of people who are not overweight at all who are getting it, who are getting it to go from being a healthy weight to being super slim, or indeed people who are super slim who have eating disorders who are getting it to actively starve themselves. It's one of the things I'm most worried about in relation to these drugs is the effect on people with eating disorders. It's why I've got a chapter about it. And eating disorders experts are extremely concerned about what's already happening. So, yeah, it's not just that people who aren't obese are getting it. It's even worse than that.
Yeah, and I can see this happening everywhere, and I can see that this is actually dominating a lot of the discourse at the moment, and rightly so. But let's get to those in a moment. I would love to cover off some of the medical risks or gaps in the science, because I think I'm getting the impression that we're galloping ahead with this technology, you know, and it is a sort of technology. And once again, as with so much in our lives today, we're thinking about or experiencing or questioning or patching up the ramifications and fallouts afterwards. You've touched on a couple of the darker sides of this, and you mentioned that you've got about a dozen in the book. Maybe you could cover off a couple that people might not be aware of. I think people have heard of the Ozempic face. That's when, the muscles we get, you know, basically our bodies, when we're not eating as much food, we then draw on our muscles. We get the energy from our muscles, and so our muscles will waste away. And so you'll have muscle loss, and that also occur in the face. I think there's things like stomach paralysis, malnutrition and gut issues. What are some of the things that we should be aware of as this drug sort of, I guess, spreads around the world?
So there's a lot of worries, and partly you have to see this through the history of previous diet drugs. So let's look at an example, Fen-Phen, the most popular diet drug prior to this in recent memory. So in the mid-90s, this diet drug was launched in the United States. The kind of hype was very similar to what people are saying about the current weight loss drugs. In 1995, there were 18 million Fen-Phen prescriptions in the United States. And then it was discovered it had a series of absolutely horrific side effects. It caused something called primary pulmonary hypertension, which is where the blood vessels in your lungs contract and you can't breathe properly and you often suffocate. And it caused a series of heart defects. And actually, it turned out, it emerged at the civil cases that then followed, the companies involved had known about these risks. There were internal memos, for example, where one of the people who worked in the company said, oh, am I going to have to spend my retirement writing compensation checks for stupid fat women who can't breathe properly? I mean, it's really chilling. Now, obviously, the biggest worry is that something like Fen-Phen plays out here. What the defenders of the drug say, and I think on this they have a good point, is this is completely different in several crucial ways. Fen-Phen was brought to market almost unbelievably based on one clinical trial of 120 people. These drugs, by contrast, are the kind of GLP-1 agonists, is the name of the class of them because they simulate GLP-1, have been now taken, you know, for 18 years by hundreds of thousands of people across the world as diabetes treatments, right? Now, it could affect diabetics differently to people with obesity, but obviously a lot of diabetics are themselves obese. So what a lot of the scientists involved say is if there was some catastrophic short to medium term effect, we would know by now, right? If there was a Fen-Phen-like effect, if it had caused primary pulmonary hypertension, for example, we would certainly be aware of that. So it's actually a relatively long amount of time for a drug to be used by large numbers of people. Against that, what critics say is, well, actually, let's dig into the diabetic population. So, for example, I interviewed a guy called Professor Jean-Luc Faye, who's a professor of pharmacology at the University Hospital in Montpellier in France. And he was put in charge by the French Medicines Agency of investigating the safety of these drugs. And France was in a really good position to do this research because France has the best medical databases in the whole world. Basically, everyone's data gets put into them. And he did something pretty simple and quite chilling. He looked at all the data for a representative group of diabetics who had been taking these drugs between 2006 and 2012. And then he compared them to a very similar group of diabetics who had not taken these drugs. And it looked like, in this early research, the people who were taking the drugs, it increased their risk of then developing thyroid cancer by between 50 and 75%. And he was looking in particular for thyroid cancer because we already knew that with animals, like for example, rats, if you give them these drugs, it massively increases their risk of thyroid cancer. Now, it's important to understand what that figure doesn't mean. It doesn't mean if you take these drugs, you are 50 to 75% likely to develop thyroid cancer. If that was the case, they would be immediately withdrawn. No one would take them. What it means is, if this research is correct, when you start to take the drug, your thyroid cancer risk increases by between 50 to 75% based on what it would have been had you never taken this drug. Now, what the scientists involved say is, look, thyroid cancer is rare. 1.2% of people who get it, the vast majority of them survive, 80%. So even a fairly big risk in that small risk leaves you overall with quite a small risk. Nonetheless, a 50 to 75% increase in the risk of a cancer is not a small risk, right? That is a big risk, as Professor Faye said to me.
I suppose if you have a family history of thyroid cancer and a predisposition to it, then it's certainly something you would want to avoid.
Well, this is why this is literally the medical guidance in the US that you should not take these if you have any history of thyroid cancer in your family.
There's also quite a few reports of people having gut issues, including stomach paralysis, where literally their stomach stops working and can't actually process the foods. I've heard, you know, a number of reports to this effect. It can get pretty gruesome. And it can also lead to malnutrition, where people are literally not eating enough of the good vitamins and so on, because they're eating so little, they're not aware that they're eating so little. And so their body's literally not getting what it needs. These are fairly huge issues, aren't they? I mean, there's been reports of deaths and severe malnutrition.
So the first set, things like pancreatitis, stomach paralysis, they are significant. The chances of those are very significantly increased by these drugs. But again, the overall risk remains extremely small. So they're extremely rare conditions, but the chances of you developing them increase by between 3 and 9 times if you take these drugs. I interviewed a woman called Michelle Stesniak, who's in Myrtle Beach in North Carolina, who, I mean, had a really horrific experience getting pancreatitis, which is an excruciatingly painful condition where your pancreas is disrupted. And she said it was more painful than childbirth by a long way. She made a full recovery. She got medical treatment, but it chilled me that when she went to the hospital with pancreatitis, they asked her two questions. Are you an extremely heavy drinker of alcohol? She said, no. Second thing they said was, are you on Ozempic? So yeah, again, very, very small risk. If you take Ozempic, your chances of getting pancreatitis still are infinitesimally small, but they hugely increase, you know, so it's a very big increase in a very small risk. Malnutrition is a much more complicated question and I think a much bigger concern, because the truth is, you know, if you don't get your dose right, or if you want to starve yourself, as we know lots of people do, if you dial your dose too high, yeah, I mean, I've got a relative taking it who her kids have to remind her to eat, right? Because she just doesn't eat. Like you say to her, you're on too high a dose. You need to come down, but she wants to lose a lot of weight very quickly. And I'm really worried, you know, so obviously anything that potentially amputates your appetite, which these drugs can lead to very, very serious problems. We know this again, the best comparison point is with bariatric surgery. Malnutrition is a very common problem after bariatric surgery. People who have bariatric surgery need to take health supplements for their whole life afterwards.
Yeah. The final one that I think, I guess it strikes me as very worrying because it's a nebulous area, is depression and suicide ideation. There is a correlation as well, isn't there?
So this is being much debated and there are scientists on both sides. I don't want to be fair to both sides. It's not totally clear yet. I know that for me, it was a strange thing, Sarah. I remember a few months into taking these drugs, I kept bumping into my friend Danielle, who was pregnant at the time. And it was like we were going in reverse trajectories, right? Like I had like a reverse pregnancy. And every time I saw her, it's like our bodies can fit together every time. But I remember having this weird sensation once I'd seen her and I came back and I thought, well, I'm really getting what I want, right? I'm losing a lot of weight. And I didn't feel pleased. I felt rather muted. I don't want to exaggerate it. I wasn't depressed, but I was surprised by how dulled my emotions seemed. And I then looked a lot at the research that, so it appears that most people taking these drugs lose weight and are very glad to lose weight and it makes them happier. But there's a quite significant minority where it seems to cause a lowness of affect. And indeed, there are concerns. There's been a safety signal raised by doctors that it may contribute to suicidal feeling in some people, although the warnings about that were assessed by the European Medicines Agency and they were not persuaded by the evidence. There's still an ongoing debate about it. There is a warning on the labels in the US that if you take it, you should be alert to the risk of suicide, increased suicidal feelings. And there's basically two possible explanations for this. There's probably truth in both of them. One of them, and this for me was challenging to think about, but ultimately helpful, is that there are five reasons why people eat. The one I would have thought of is the most obvious is, well, obviously we eat for nutrition to sustain our bodies, right? I would have thought that was the main reason why I ate a year and a half ago. But the truth is I used to eat about 3,200 calories a day. And now I eat about 1,800. And here I am. I'm alive and well. I'm healthier than I've ever been. So all those other calories were doing something else, right? And I go through in the book the other reasons why we eat. But there's a kind of obvious one that I really realized how much had played out for me when I started taking these drugs, which is we eat for comfort. We eat to reassure and soothe ourselves, right? We eat to stabilize our emotions. This is a big thing for a lot of people. And what happens when you take these drugs is you can't do that anymore, right? I remember having a day, it must have been about 6 months into taking the drugs, where I had a bad day, not like horrific, but a bad day. And I went to KFC and almost on autopilot, I ordered what I would have ordered a year ago if I'd had a bad day, right? Which was an enormous bucket of fried chicken. And I sat there and I had two mouthfuls and I just couldn't eat anymore. And I remember seeing the image of Colonel Sanders looking down at me like he was going, hey, what's wrong with our best customer? And I thought, oh, you're just going to have to sit with these feelings, right? You're not able to swamp them in saturated fats. So I think one of the things that happens is that when you take these drugs, the underlying emotional reasons why you ate can often begin to come to the surface. Now, there's an advantage to that. If they come to the surface, you can begin to deal with them in more healthy ways, hopefully. But for lots of people, I think that's harder. So it's partly that. So that's the sort of psychological set of explanations. There's another potential set of explanations, which are more complicated and more contested. So it's becoming increasingly clear that these drugs do not primarily work on the gut, although they clearly have an effect on the gut. They primarily work by changing your brain. I interviewed loads of the neuroscientists who are doing the cutting edge research on this. These drugs change your preferences. They change what you want. They're affecting, in fact, Robert Kushner, who's been involved in a key part of many of the trials for these drugs, said, you know, if you tag Ozempic, you diet a certain color or these drugs, comparable drugs, and you give them to an animal and then you cut the animal's brain open, what you see is that these drugs go everywhere in your brain, to almost every part of your brain. They're having a profound effect on your brain. And slightly disconcertingly, we don't know what effect that is. I interview the leading cutting edge neuroscientists and they're like, we don't really know how to describe what it's doing to your brain. We don't really know what it's doing. Now, one of them, Dr. Clémence Bluet, who's researching this at Cambridge University, said to me, look, the brain is by some measure the most complex object in the whole universe. It takes a bit of time to figure out how these things work. But one theory about how the effect it has on the brain, and I want to stress it's one theory, it's very contested. There are lots of other theories. But one theory is that, so you have in your brain something called the reward system. So whenever you do anything that's rewarding, that makes you feel good, that's because your reward system buzzes. You have sex, reward system. You exercise, that's the reward system humming. You eat, that's the reward system humming. And one argument is that these drugs might be working by dialing down your reward system. You actually find food less rewarding. Certainly lots of people seem to be reporting a loss of pleasure in food when they take these drugs, which obviously begs the question, which I put to lots of the scientists, well, okay, if it dials down my pleasure for jam sandwiches, would it, I don't know, if I was Elton John, would it dial down my pleasure in jamming out music, right? Can it dial down your pleasure in food without dialing down these other forms of pleasure? And the scientists I spoke to did not agree. Some said, yes, I'm really worried about this. This is a real concern. Others said, well, we're not seeing increased depression among the diabetics who take it. We're not getting reports of people becoming what's called anhedonic, where they don't take any pleasure in life, although there are some warnings about suicide. So it's a complicated picture. There are other theories about what's happening in the brain. I go through them in the book. There are a few things that are really big red warning signs to me that we have to weigh alongside the very, very big benefits to these drugs. And there's a few that are really big for me: thyroid, depression, eating disorders, pregnancy. When we give these drugs to pregnant animals, they can cause horrendous birth defects. There's a lot we don't know about pregnant women taking these drugs. Obviously, women who don't know they're trying to get pregnant, if you are trying to get pregnant, they tell you not to take them. But obviously, people get pregnant in all sorts of situations that they weren't planning. So yeah, there are other ones I could go through. I list them in the book. But yeah, there's lots of worries here.
Yeah, I think anything that mucks with hormones is going to have a whole domino effect throughout the body. And
I think that's true, Sarah, but I would just say in response to it, obesity mucks with your hormones as well. This is one of the really big challenges for all the negative effects of the drugs. And there are some definite negative effects and some potential negative effects. The scientists involved keep saying, but you have to weigh them against the effects of ongoing obesity, right? So think about the thyroid cancer risk, right? Okay, so it increases your risk of thyroid cancer if that research by Professor Faye is right, by between 50 and 75%. But obesity increases your risk of a whole range of cancers by a really significant amount. Cancer Research UK, the biggest group in Britain on this, you know, they warn. So if you carry excess weight, that weight doesn't just sit there inert. It's active. It does things in your body. And one of the things it does is it sends signals to your cells to divide more rapidly, which is why you get an increased, really significantly increased cancer risk when you carry excess weight. So it was very challenging working on this because I was constantly trying to weigh for myself and for other people, including a lot of people I love, these two competing sets of risks, the risks of continuing to be obese and carry excess weight and the risks of these drugs. And it's a very hard calculation that everyone who's able to get hold of these drugs and wants to take them is going to have to weigh for themselves. And different people are going to reach very different conclusions based on the risks that I present in the book, I think.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The part of the book that I think is most significant and I found most interesting, that's the sociological impact and ramifications of all of this. I think something that you really pick up on is how these drugs mask what really is at play here. So sure, it's great that we are getting rid of this idea that it's a lack of willpower which causes people to become overweight and obese. And that, I think, has been a really important part of this discussion because it's opened us up to the idea that, yes, well, overweight is also biological and we can address it with a drug that works at a biological level. But a really big part of obesity and all the associated health concerns is the fact that we live in a society that has been force-feeding us processed food that is full of hormones and chemicals that work on our brains, that work on our bodies, and we actually aren't eating in an intuitive way, in a way that is in attunement with the way that our bodies evolved. And we're bludgeoned with messaging that makes it very, very difficult to make true food choices. And so it plays at our emotional level and all kinds of things. And so there's the argument that this magic pill sort of almost overlooks this or enables a society to overlook it. And we can just get on with life by almost like fixing the problem with the same mindset or consciousness that caused it in the first place, which of course, as Einstein says, is the definition of madness. So I feel this is a really interesting point to flesh out, that while ever we're just talking the to's and fro's of health benefits and risks, we're also shutting down debate around the original issue here. And while ever we shut it down, we sort of let the big food giants, the big corporations get off scot-free. And you wrote a chapter that actually showed that some of the, well, I guess the science that's been done in the processed food realm is very similar to the science that's been done in this weight loss drug realm, because they're both talking about appetite hormones and satiety. Can you talk a little bit through your concerns in that area? We've already talked on the body positivity movement. You've also touched on the impact of these drugs on eating disorders. We've now had Oprah come out and endorse these drugs. So we're going to have the Oprah effect, which is going to dial things up even further. But I think the discussion that needs to be had is around, you know, these processed foods.
Yeah. So as you know, there's been an enormous increase in obesity. Actually, curiously, it more or less began the year I was born, 1979. I'm not blaming myself. I'm not like some Damien figure from The Omen who unleashed obesity on the world. But if you look at, so when my parents were at school, there were almost no obese people in Britain, right? The year I was born, 6% of British people were obese. Now it's 27%. The average American is 23 pounds heavier than the average American was in 1960. So there's been this extraordinary explosion in obesity in a very short period of time. That has never happened before in the whole of human history. And you want to think about, well, why did this happen, right? What's going on? It's not because there was some sudden collapse in willpower. It's because there was a huge transformation in the nature of the food that we are offered, that we are given, and that is promoted to us. The way Professor Gerald Mand, who's one of the leading nutritionists at Harvard, he designed the label that goes on all food in the United States. The way he put it to me, there's something about the diet we're eating that is interrupting with our ability to know when to stop, right? The food we eat bears, this is me speaking now, not him. The food we eat bears almost no relationship to what human beings ate a few generations ago and for the entire 300,000 years before that, right? The food we eat now, 78% of all the calories that the average American child gets comes from what's called ultra-processed food, which means food that is assembled entirely in a factory and bears no relationship to the kind of ordinary food that my grandparents or your grandparents would have eaten.
We had Dr. Chris Van Tulken on.
Oh, love him.
Yes, that's right. And of course, he and I come from slightly different perspectives. He's coming from the ultra-processed food perspective. I, as you know, wrote a series of books about quitting sugar. This is, you know, 13, 14 years ago now. The common thing, I think, is this idea of the appetite derangement element of these foods. Yeah, which feeds into some of the stuff you're saying about these weight loss drugs. Again, we're working at this level of appetite hormones being deranged and being mucked with, where our bodies can't work out what they need any longer, to a point where we can't even correct afterwards.
I thought it was so interesting at first. When I was doing the research, I thought I was looking at these two kind of parallel lines. One was why so many of us gained so much weight, and the other was how the weight loss drugs work. But actually, the same word kept cropping up in both conversations. And it's a word that we don't use that often in everyday language. It's satiety. Satiety is the feeling of being sated, the feeling that you've just had enough and you don't want any more, right? And what we know is two things. Processed food profoundly undermines our sense of satiety. I go through the seven reasons the scientists have discovered for why that is in the book. And what these drugs do is they restore your sense of satiety. In fact, one of the scientists who developed the drugs calls them satiety hormones, right? What the drugs give you. And I kind of realized, I was discussing with an amazing man named Professor Michael Lowe, who's a professor of psychology at Drexel University, one of the leading experts in the world on hunger. And he said to me, well, it's very simple. These drugs are an artificial solution to an artificial problem, right? We artificially create the problem, an inability to feel sated through a lifetime of eating these processed foods. And it really is a lifetime. More 3-year-old children know what the McDonald's M means than know their own last name. So we're talking about a lifetime of being absolutely inculcated in these processed foods. That was, I mean, I think I ate nothing but processed foods throughout until I was in my 20s. And then these drugs step in to fill the artificially filled hole. I remember one night going to one of my closest friends, who I call Judy in the book, and saying, I've got to stop taking these drugs. I'm a complete hypocrite here. You know, I've written all these books in the past about how you need to deal with the underlying causes of crises. You shouldn't just superficially deal with the symptoms. And here I am injecting myself to deal with this kind of problem that's clearly caused by the food system and these much wider forces. And, you know, Judy had very bad breast cancer 7-8 years ago now and nearly died. And she's a single mother. It was horrific. And I was there with her all through that journey and all through her treatment. And she said to me, Johan, when I got cancer, it was very clear to me and you that there is something terribly wrong with the environment we live in. 1 in 7 women get breast cancer in Britain. That didn't used to be the case. It's not the case in a lot of other countries. In Japan, it's 1 in 38 women, right? There is something really wrong with our environment that is making significantly more women get breast cancer. But when I got breast cancer, you didn't say to me, well, fuck me. The environment's poisoned you and now you're filling yourself with chemotherapy to do it. Don't do that. Deal with the underlying causes, right? What you said to me is, yes, the environment has done something terrible to you, but now we've got to make sure you survive and live to fight another day. And then we can deal with the environment, right? And she said, if you quit now, when it comes to these drugs, she came up with an analogy that really helped me. She said, it's like your house is on fire and you're saying, you know, we need to change the building code so every house has sprinklers from now on. That's a really good idea. I'm with you on the sprinkler campaign, but right now you need to call the fucking fire brigade and put out the fire in your house. And it really clarified it for me. Not long afterwards, I spoke to a guy called Jeff Parker, who's in San Francisco, a lovely guy. He's 66 years old. He's a retired lighting engineer. And when he retired, by the time he retired, he was extremely overweight and he was having kidney problems. He was having liver problems. He had gout. He was struggling to walk. And he started taking Mounjaro, one of the weight loss drugs. And he lost an enormous amount of weight. And his kidney and liver problems went away. His gout went away. Now every day he walks his dog over the Golden Gate Bridge. And I put this concern to him. And he said, look, if you want to fight to deal with the environmental causes of obesity, I am 100% on your side. Sign me up for that campaign. I'm with you. But I've got to tell you, by the time we make those changes, I'll be dead. Right? And I want to live. So I did find those arguments hard to refute. Now, that doesn't mean we don't need to also do all the other stuff. 100% we need to do all the other stuff. And a lot of the book is about what that other stuff is and how we can get there. But I don't think I can say to Jeff, yeah, you should die now to prove how bad the situation is because that will somehow spur better change. I should say that to myself, right? You know, that I should risk my own health to make some point about systemic health. I don't see how that helps anyone.
Yeah. It's a really difficult one. And I like the way that you deal with it in your book, including listing resources and places where people can start to campaign against these ultra processed foods. And I think that's really important. I might actually put a few of those for listeners in the show notes, if that's okay. Of course, they can also go to read about it in your book. But
Sarah, can I just say one just one thing, because you've referenced the title a few times, which I'm very grateful for. Thank you. And I just want to let the listeners know that. So I call the drugs a magic pill and I say they're increasingly going to be available as pills. There's three possible meanings of that, right? So one, and it's fascinating to me that after a year of deeply researching this, I'm still not sure which is the case. So they could be a magic pill in the sense that they solve the problem so effectively and so rapidly that it appears like magic, right? Or they could be magic in the sense of a magic trick, right? A con, an illusion. They seem to solve the problem, but they actually screw us over, the kind of fen-phen scenario that we were talking about. Or There's a third way in which they could be magic. If you look at most stories of magic, you get find the genie, you find the lamp, you find the genie, you get to make a wish. What generally happens is you get what you want, and then you get a load of things you never expected, right? The genie grants your wish, but not quite in the way that you meant for him to do. And you think about Fantasia, right? Mickey Mouse has all this magic and it spirals away from him. And it's perfectly possible that we end up with the third understanding of magic, right? That this unleashes a whole series of effects that we don't understand. Barclays Bank commissioned a really sober-minded financial analyst called Emily Field to research their advice for investors in relation to these drugs, right? Because obviously they're giving people long-term investment advice the whole time. And she came back and said, if you want a comparison for the effects of these drugs, you're going to have to look at the invention of the smartphone, right? This is going to have all sorts of wildly unpredictable effects. If we were talking in 2007, we could not have predicted the role the iPhone would play in, I don't know, TikTok, Trump, a whole range of things, right? So I think we can begin to see some of the strands, some very positive strands. Krispy Kreme donuts, their stocks are tanking. Jefferies Financial Analysis Group told the US airlines they're going to have to spend a lot less money on jet fuel pretty soon because a slimmer population takes less to fly, costs less to fly because it takes less jet fuel. And then there are really worrying trends, you know, eating disorders, all sorts of potential risks and worries that we could be looking at. So I think we can begin through the book to see, and through the evidence to see, some of the potential cultural benefits and cultural risks here. And you might be listening to this and thinking, you know, I don't want to take these drugs. I never want to take these drugs. I'm not interested. But in the same way that you might not be interested in the iPhone, but the iPhone has transformed the environment around you. So you've got to know a lot about the effects of the iPhone. In the same way, even if you're not interested in these drugs are coming like a tidal wave. 47% of Americans say in polling they want to take these drugs. And as the price comes down, and it will come down, I can explain why, enormous numbers of people are going to be taking these drugs with enormous numbers of effects, both good and bad.
You've brought up so much there, and I do want to touch on the financial side of things. But one of the, I guess, the ripple-on effects that I'm thinking about here, and tell me if I've got this right, if this is in fact happening. I imagine that if you're taking this drug and you're feeling like, wow, tick, this is now covered for me. I'm feeling better. I'm losing the weight. Do people then start to, well, I suppose, not focus on the processed food companies, but equally, do they stop doing exercise or caring about the food system and ensuring food is nutritious and, you know, and that we're getting the right kind of calories? Does Ozempic and these diet drugs, do they tend to shut down those considerations? And just while I'm thinking of it, because you can probably answer it in a similar way, I heard some expert at some point, I think they've been quoted a number of times, say, well, what will happen to the dinner party? You know, like when food was such a kind of a focus in our culture, it brings people together. People delight over food and have done for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, I would say. What happens when you have a huge amount of people who just don't want to eat and there's not that relationship glue? My mind is sort of ticking over all of these kinds of sociological concerns. Are you coming across those kinds of things too?
Totally. And it's why I write about all of them in the book, that I think you're absolutely right. So there's a few things you said there. So one is the concern that it will drain the political energy to challenge the food companies. And that's a big worry for me, that in a sense people go, oh, well, the problem's solved anyway. We'll just give everyone these drugs and then we don't have to challenge the power of the food companies. And I've got a slightly depressing answer on that, which is whenever I put that to people, they said, what energy to challenge the food companies? Where is it? Where was it the year before Ozempic was created? You know, a figure as charismatic and brilliant and persuasive as Michelle Obama could not get us fired up to challenge the power of the food companies, right? Now, that's a slightly depressing way of thinking of it. And I absolutely believe we can get the power and energy to challenge the food companies. And I went to countries that have challenged the power of food companies, like Japan, where they have extremely low levels of obesity. So I do worry about that. But I also think we had no political energy to challenge it before anyway. Right now, that doesn't mean we can't build it up. You can always build up political energy. There was no political energy to challenge, you know, no one had ever proposed gay marriage ever in the 1980s. And we got such political energy that now it's spreading all over the world. So you could always build political energy. But I don't see it can drain it from a point of zero, right, is the depressing answer to that. The second part, which is, does it make people exercise less? I worry about that. So we know that there are independent health benefits to exercise, which are separable to some degree from weight, right? So if you lose weight through these drugs, but you don't exercise at all, we know that not exercising correlates with all sorts of health problems. So that's a worry. I think that's a very legitimate worry. You know, my personal trainer was saying, God, I hope most of my clients don't read your book because they'll stop coming to see me, right? So that's a real issue. I think you went to one of the most interesting and knotty ones, which is the loss of pleasure and the loss of communal eating. You know, I've got a friend called Elise Lonan, who I interviewed for the book, who she used to be the head of wellbeing for Goop and quit and has become a very interesting critic of that whole wellness. And she said, I won't go out for dinner with people in LA now because no one fucking eats anything. I'm like, why am I here? Why did we come out to a restaurant? None of you are eating anything. But I mean, that's a very extreme example. But so a lot of people, as I mentioned before, describe their experience of taking these drugs as a loss of pleasure in food. So, for example, here in Britain, there's a brilliant food critic called Jay Rayner who started taking the drugs and just said, this is just so miserable, right? You know, he would go out. It's obviously someone for whom love of food was a really important part of his life. And he described going into all these amazing restaurants in Paris and just feeling nothing, right? And actually, even one of the scientists who developed these drugs, Jens-Jules Holst, has said, you know, some people just find it so miserable that they just quit these drugs because just what is life if you get no pleasure from food, right? And I have to say, my experience, and I want to stress, I think my experience is unusual, was the opposite of that. So, but for a slightly depressing, again, this is the depressing part of the conversation, a slightly depressing reason, I realized when I started taking these drugs that I got almost no pleasure from food my whole life. Or rather, that I got it in a very particular way. So I grew up in a very violent and chaotic family and environment, and where one of the drivers of that violence was actually a disagreement about how I ate that I talk about in the book. My dad was horrified by how I ate. My mother fed me lots of shit, and my dad was enraged by it. One of the, I think the primary pleasure by far I got from food all my life was not through tasting the food, but from the sensation of being stuffed. So I would eat very rapidly. And stuffing is where you eat beyond the point of feeling full. And it's a very specific feeling. Everyone will have had it at some point, maybe Christmas Day or something. And it's where you feel your stomach being pushed out and your pressure upwards on your esophagus because you've eaten too much. And I think a lot of my eating, not all of it, but a lot of my eating was around seeking that sensation, which I found quite comforting. And on Ozempic, I couldn't do that, right? But what it meant was actually my eating massively slowed down when I ate, when I was on Ozempic. I actually remember going out for dinner with my friend Sarah, maybe, I don't know, 7-8 months into taking the drugs, and her saying, you know, it's always been weird eating with you because you would eat so much, but you never seem to be taking any pleasure in the food. And actually, it's quite touching now, she said, that you actually seem to taste your food. It looks like you're actually enjoying it a bit more. Just before we spoke, I had some sashimi from the lovely Japanese place up the road, which is absolutely delicious. And I dipped it in the soy sauce and I tasted the soy sauce and I tasted the sashimi. I wouldn't want to overstate it. I'm never going to be a foodie. I'm not that guy. I'm not somebody who takes a great deal of aesthetic pleasure generally, but except in men. But I think from an extremely low level, I get a little bit more pleasure in food now than I used to. But again, I don't want to present myself as typical because I'm not. Far more people are like Jay Rayner, and it drains their pleasure in food than are like me, I think.
You mentioned you would talk through the financial piece here. One of the things that sprung to mind when I first heard about it, and I think it's been written about a little, is this idea that it's going to split the haves and the have-nots. There are going to be the elite rich who can buy it, as you say, to go from fairly slim to super slim. There are debates already raging about the drug being bought up by, you know, wealthy people who are using it for that purpose. And then those who actually need it, people with obesity, but also with diabetes, are not able to access the drugs. I sort of see that as a big issue. Whenever I hear about another have versus have nots, alarm bells ring for me. But you did say that, but I think there's an interim period where there's also the insurance company issue in the US. I think insurance companies cover it to a certain extent, but then of course there's a lot of people who don't have health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. Where are we at there with the cost of the drugs and people missing out and it creating this real divide. And I'm you know, this is what people are talking about when they're talking about this issue.
Yeah. So this is one of my biggest concerns as well. So you could imagine a dystopian scenario where the Real Housewives of New Jersey get to be super, super thin and the real school children of New Jersey get diabetes at the age of 12, right?
And this is where you get to in the book, isn't it? Because I sort of read, I had to read your book super fast because it's actually not out yet. By the time people are listening to this, it will have been published, but I think I was one of the first people to read it. But you get to a point where you're like, oh, okay, he's, you know, weighed up, so to speak, all the pros and cons backwards and forwards. And he's arrived at this sort of this point, this, you know, almost to where we've got to in this conversation. But then you go, there's one last consideration that really tore at you. I suspect we're getting to that now when it comes to the kids element.
The first people to read the book were the marketing, apart from my editors were the, and a few of my friends, were the marketing departments for my American and my British publishers. And it was so interesting going to the meetings because some of the people, obviously I know the marketing people love them. Some of them came up to me and said, I loved your book, Johan. It made me absolutely convinced to go out and get Ozempic. And then other people came up to me and said, Johan, I loved your book. It made me convinced I'd be fucking mad to go and buy Ozempic, right? And it was almost like the kind of dress. You remember the kind of gold, blue dress thing?
Yes, yeah, from a few years ago.
And I thought, oh, actually, that's a sign that I've done my job well, that I presented the evidence for both sides and people are able to make up their own minds. But one of the big concerns I have is what you're describing. So it doesn't actually cost very much to make these drugs. It costs about $40 per person per month. But in the United States, people live it. When I'm in Vegas, I have to pay $1,200 a month. And here in Britain, I pay £200 a month. So much less in Britain than in the US. And the reason for that gap is the profit that goes to the companies that develop these drugs, Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly. Now, what they argue is, look, we invested an enormous amount in developing these drugs. You know, most of the drugs that are trialed for development never get to this point. You know, we use this money to invest in new forms of development, and therefore we deserve to make a profit. I think that's true. I don't think they need to make this much profit, right? I mean, $200 billion, you know, they're now the most, Novo Nordisk is now the most valuable company in Europe.
I read that.
Yeah. I mean, actually, it's been a huge boost to the entire economy of Denmark because they're a Danish company, like an enormous growth in Danish GDP just because of this, right? That's how big they are. The price will certainly come down in the medium term because in 2032, the drugs go out of patent. So at that point, anyone can make them for $40 a month, and by then they will be pills. So 2032 is quite a while away. We took, what are we, 8 years off? But it's not that far, right, in terms of human history. In the interim, though, there are several ways in which the price might come down. So in Britain and Australia, you know, the healthcare systems might actually buy them in bulk because it saves so much money further down the line. In the US, it's possible that it'll finally make them take on the prices of the drug companies. They have done that for some things. President Biden has taken on the cost of insulin, for example, by regulating the drug companies. So it's possible that there'll be some kind of government action. I mean, you never want to bet your life on the American government taking action to regulate corporations. So, you know, somewhat skeptical, but that might happen. Or the companies might compete. They might decide they'd rather compete for a mass market of lots of people at a lower price, given how many people want it, rather than a kind of more select boutique elite audience at really high price. So there's all sorts of potential scenarios where the price could come down, and certainly in 2032, the price will crash, right? So I worry a lot about that differential access. You could see it another way, which is that rich people have volunteered themselves as the guinea pigs to see if these drugs are safe.
And actually, people
in Hollywood are going to die first if it all goes horribly wrong. So actually, there's another way of thinking about it. But and it's a rare instance where rich people volunteer themselves to be the guinea pigs rather than finding the most poor and vulnerable people in society. So you can think about this in different ways.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the debate that we've been discussing here relates to people who have obesity. And, you know, you've got to weigh up the health benefits and costs for having obesity versus taking these drugs. But for people who are just slim and want to be slimmer, really, it's a different debate, which people can probably work out for themselves.
Well, they're really endangering their own health as well.
That's right. They're opting in for that. But we touched on the kids thing because I feel that you arrived at a point at the end of your book, And as I say, this was the bit that I had to speed read over because I ran out of time before this interview. But it seemed like there was a last consideration that sort of tipped you one way or the other, or left you with red flags still flying. What was that?
It's so interesting. Normally by the end of a book, you know, there's some kind of ambiguities that I have. But at the end of writing a book, normally I'm like, okay, I know what I think now.
In the final wash up, here we are. Yeah.
Exactly. With this book, it really wasn't like that. You know, one of my favorite writers, Graham Greene, said, when we are unsure, we are alive. And I was like, okay, at least I'm alive. But at the end, when I started investigating, there's a big debate now about whether to give these drugs to children and how young you should give them. Novo Nordisk are currently doing a trial of giving these drugs to six-year-old children. And I remember just feeling so uncomfortable. It's like, okay, I can take this risk for myself. I'm an adult. If this goes tits up, the person who pays the price is me. If I had a child who was obese, especially you think about the US, you know, they spend the food companies spend $1 billion a year marketing shitty food to children in the US. I remember thinking, this is so hard. And what it does is it takes all that uncertainty you feel about balancing the risks of obesity versus balancing the risks of the drugs and just dials it up to 10, right? And I spoke to an amazing woman called Deborah Tyler, who I really felt for. She's in New England. So her daughter just gained an enormous amount of weight when she was very young. And by the time she was 10, she had liver problems. And her mother was really, you can imagine how wrenched the mother felt about that, right? And so she started giving her daughter, reluctantly and with a huge amount of concern, the doctor gave her daughter Ozempic. The daughter lost a lot of weight. Her liver function began to be restored. And then Deborah's healthcare company threw her daughter off the prescription and all this weight came back. And so now Deborah, she's a nurse, she doesn't have a huge amount of money, is buying out of pocket these drugs for her daughter. And she's like, look, I keep asking myself, am I crazy? Is this the wrong thing to do? You know, and she's really conflicted about it. And I really felt for her. And I thought, God, what would I do in that situation? I genuinely don't know. But it just raises all the stakes. You think about, you know, if you have to take these drugs your whole life, if you're giving them to a 10-year-old child, that's 70 years of taking this drug. It's an enormous amount of money. That's an enormous amount of long-term risk. And it's another one of the things that worries me about these drugs is what I think of, to borrow a phrase from Donald Rumsfeld, is the unknown unknowns, right? The things we can't quite game out. So think about, for example, and this was raised to me by a brilliant scientist who's researching these drugs at Florida State University called Greg Stanward. Think about antipsychotics, right? So antipsychotics started being given to people in the 1950s and 1960s, and doctors judged that they were broadly safe. There's a huge debate about whether they're good for people, but set that aside for a minute. Doctors judged that they were broadly safe. And it was only 50 years later that it was discovered that if you take these drugs, you're much more likely to develop dementia. Now, you couldn't have known that at the start. You had to have people taking them for 50 years, well, for a very long period of time, to get old enough to get dementia, right? So I'm not suggesting that these drugs will cause dementia at all. What I'm suggesting is there may be some unknown long-term side effect that just no one can anticipate at the moment. Now, obviously, that's a bigger concern if you're giving them to children. If you're 70 and you start taking these drugs, well, your long-term horizon is 20 years, if you're lucky. A long-term horizon of, you know, 70 years, there's a lot of risk and indeterminacy in that. But it comes back to what Dr. Shauna Levy, who works at the Tulane School of Medicine in New Orleans, said to me. We don't know the long-term risks of these weight loss drugs. We do know the long-term risks of obesity, and they are really significant. So again, it's very agonizing. And lots of people are going to be hearing that and thinking what I thought, which is, well, why is that the choice? Why don't you go on a diet, right? And that's particularly, you always want to try that first, particularly with children. But I go through the evidence in the book, the very depressing evidence in the book, that actually the vast majority of diets don't work.
My third route is, can't we just finally take down the food companies? But having worked in that space for so long, I don't know that it's going to happen in my lifetime.
Well, I'll tell you what gives me hope about that. There's a lot of pessimistic about it. But so I went to lots of countries that have done a huge amount to challenged the power of the food companies. I went to Mexico where they got a sugar tax. I went to Amsterdam where they give every kid who's overweight a personal trainer and loads of family support, and they've massively reduced childhood obesity. I went to Minneapolis where they prescribe fresh, healthy food for poor people who otherwise couldn't afford it, as a massively positive effect on their health. So there's loads of places that have begun this fight. And I went to Japan. Japan has 4% obesity compared to 42% in the United States. Japan is the only country in the world that got rich without getting fat. And it did it through a series of concerted government policies that I go through in the book that we could adopt. Japan didn't always have a healthy diet. In the 1920s, Japan had an unbelievably unhealthy diet. They hardly ate any fish at all. They only got protein once a week. The Japanese government invented a whole new food culture and system through top-down government fiat, which is maintained through these, partly through the culture, but partly through very strong government policies that I describe in the book. We can do that. If Mexico can do it, if Amsterdam can do it, if Japan can do it, we can do these things if we want to. But they won't happen by accident. We have to come together and fight to them. And one of the things I hope about these drugs is that whether you're in favor of these drugs or you're against these drugs, and there are very reasonable people on both sides, and I'm very conflicted, we should all be able to say, how the fuck did we get to the point where this is the choice we face? The risks of obesity or potentially risky drugs, why are we inflicting this on our children? Let's change the food system so our kids don't have to make this shitty choice year after year, generation after generation. And I absolutely believe we can wake up and we can do that.
Well, that's probably a good note to finish on. I think you do tend to write books that leave open questions, and I think that's important. I think, as you say, there are a lot of unknown unknowns, and we need to be able to sit in that, and we can tackle the obesity and overweight issue potentially with these drugs, and we can also tackle the ultra-processed food debacle, and we should. Hey, Johan, thank you so much. I look forward to you going and finding another dilemma to go and wrestle with down the track so that we can talk again. And I wish you luck with all of this, and I wish you luck with the book tour. I think it'll be a very, very potent one, and don't exhaust yourself doing it.
Oh, thanks so much, Sarah. I really enjoyed this conversation. I always really enjoy talking to you. And I meant to say on my publisher's tase me that people who want to know where to get the audiobook, the ebook, or the physical book, you can basically get it anywhere that sells books. But if you want to see more information, you can go to my website, which is johannhari.com. Hooray!
I'll put all of that in the show notes so that people can click straight on it. We will speak soon. Go forth and get people thinking. Thanks, Johan.
Thanks, Sarah.
I really do like that line that Johan quotes from Graham Greene, when we are not sure, we are alive. I mean, it's an adage for just about everything. Indeed, I'm finding it really hard to have a hot take on this subject. I get the position we are in regarding obesity. Johan makes the point in his book that he doesn't live in the better future. He lives in the imperfect present and has to deal with the reality that is in, that we are all in and have inherited. Our appetites have been almost irreversibly mucked with. But how do we ensure we attend to people's suffering in this imperfect present and not let the debate, our care, our fight end there? How do we provide band-aids and go fix the original wound? How do we, when there's so much going on in the world today, fight the system from within the system? I'm not sure, to be honest. I do know, however, that the bare minimum that we must do is not let these kinds of issues die where big food or big pharma would like to have them die. We need to keep learning, debating, having conversations like the one Johan is having. We have to train the part of our brain that deals with complexity and nuance and moral quandaries. We need to be able to get better at living in the this and realm. We also need to fight to keep our kids off processed food now, to keep their appetite systems intact as best as possible. There is a statement from the conversation that is still ringing in my ears. You might recall Johan talking about how the people that are gets thin at the moment and are using these drugs for aesthetic ends only, so to become even thinner. So we're talking about the privileged, the Hollywood set. They're kind of taking all the risk without the balancing out of of the benefits of the drugs, so beyond, of course, becoming even thinner. And so they may wind up being this scientific experiment's guinea pigs or lab rats. And I was thinking, perhaps for anyone feeling the Moloch-like pull to join this particular race to the bottom, well, this might be something to keep in mind amidst everything else. One upside to all of this that Johan and I didn't cover in the conversation is that these drugs have also turned the fitness and weight loss industries upside down. These are the industries that have capitalized on the false science, the false story that weight loss is a matter of willpower, calorie counting, and draconian fitness regimes. It's also shifted the conversation around weight and weight loss to a more compassionate understanding of the way that hormones and our biology actually works, and has ironically opened more people up to the vested interests of big corporations, big pharma, and so on. Okay, so if you would like to discuss what Johan and I cover in this conversation further, you can post your comments anywhere over at Substack. That's sarahwilson.substack.com. Post anywhere, on any post, I will find it. Until next week's conversation with yet another wild guest, stay wild yourself and stay open to more this and like conversations.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.